Okay, this is my little intro. I always try to give you, beside we get in the meat of it, I always try to give you a little intro. This is a great site, whatsinmyfood.org. The reason I pulled this up and have it here is because I'm thinking, man, you know, I'm doing this to avoid chemicals and avoid toxic rescue farming. I call it toxic rescue farming. When you have a problem, you go get a toxin, and that'll solve your problem. No, we don't want to get into toxic rescue farming. But sweet potatoes, at least where I live, are really easy to grow. They're in the morning glory family. You ever had morning glory problems? I mean, people grow them as flowers, but I think they're a weed. You know, they get into your crops and they have pretty flowers, but man, they take over. You know, they're kind of like kudzu, you know? Going to this website, and I thought sweet potatoes, anybody can grow a sweet potato because it's basically a weed, and actually it's not even a potato. It's really a swollen root. A potato is really a potato, you know, like an Idaho potato. That's a under storage food pod. But sweet potatoes are just swollen roots. That's all they are. They call them sweet potatoes because I guess they grow underground. But anybody can grow a sweet potato. They're really easy to grow. And when people are first starting off and they have weed problems and all this stuff, I say, grow sweet potatoes. Even if you have just buds of sweet potatoes, you know, you'll get some food out of it. And they're super easy to grow once they get started. You know, you have to weed them a couple times in the beginning. But then they get this huge canopy, and they're low to the ground. They're not tall. You don't have to trellis or anything like that. And they just sit there, and you really don't have to water them a lot. They can grow deep and get the water, and they're pretty much maintenance-free crop, and they break up your soil when it's tight, you know what I mean? And you dig them, and that breaks up your soil. So sweet potatoes are a great first crop for the beginning farmer to grow. They don't get I have never experienced a lot of disease problems with them. I've heard people having scab and all this kind of stuff, but it never happened to me. And they're just really easy, and they do break up your ground good. And I thought, well, there's probably, even in the chemical world, in conventional agriculture, they probably don't use a lot of chemicals. Probably I can go to the store and buy a sweet potato and not have to worry about any chemical residue, right? Well, I was wrong. You pull up this page and it'll tell you there's the top eight pesticides used on sweet potatoes, Dacloran, and this one's used a lot. 40% of the sweet potatoes in the store, grown conventionally, have used this Dicloran. I don't know, conventional versus organic, but anyway, toxicity, this tells you it's a possible carcinogen. Not confirmed yet, but they're looking at it. Then you got DDE down there, whatever that is. And I don't have I can't scroll down because it's just a snapshot of it. But there's just like eight different ones all the way down, and they range from, you know, carcinogens to hormone disruptors to neurotoxins to reproductive toxins to hard on bees. So that's a good website. You just go down here and pick out whatever you're interested in. It'll tell you what they're presently using on those crops and in what percentage you'll find it. Okay, I don't want to get personal here, but I had met and had bought a lot of early on when I was an early Adventist and I came in on the health message. Vicki and Dane Griffith's videos. You ever heard anything that Let's Eat? Now I heard Dane died recently of cancer, and I heard Vicki Vicki's very prominent up in Michigan, and
she's here.
Yeah. She's here. Yeah. Oh, she did. I think the year before she was supposed to be here, but because of the sicknesses, she didn't make it or whatever. You know pretty well. Well, I heard, I heard that she went through a rough patch because, you know, a lot of evidence sort of got like, well, he must have been doing something wrong. And, you know, that was hard to take when you just lose your husband.
Yeah.
And she almost left, I heard, the church over that because she was a little annoyed. And because they were out there preaching the health message, they lived it. And here Dane gets, I think he had kidney cancer or something like that. Well, you know, I don't know why that happened, but this is at least a possibility. A lot of them are known carcinogens. I'm not saying that's the case. I don't know, but I'm saying at least it needs to be brought to the table and discussed. Okay. Okay, let me get through this, okay? Because some people aren't you know how questions are. Some people are interested, some people are not, and some people are here just to hear the material, so let's don't rip them off, because they paid $180 too, right? okay, here's an interesting graph I pulled up. The dotted blue line is a decline in mineral content of the vegetables. It all started post-World War II, when the war industry started, let's declare war on bugs, or let's declare war on funguses, and so we can keep our plants open and keep our factories open, because the war is over. And we started spraying all these pesticides, you know, from about World War II on, it really kicked in. And you can see the mineral content in the vegetables went down per milligram, but the red line is an increase in mineral deficient diseases. So as chemical agriculture came online post-World War II, medical costs rose and mineral contents in the food went down. Because that's what pesticides do. When you artificially, and when you disregard nature and you artificially chemicalize your soils to grow a crop and get yield and declare war on bugs and declare war on weeds with all your chemicals, you're going to reduce the nutrient content in your food, lots of nutrient contents. And when you reduce the nutrient content, you're still eating the vegetables, you're being a good Adventist vegetarian, but you're still going to get mineral deficient diseases because it's not in the food anymore because of the way we farm. And this graph kind of shows that. U.S. Department of Agriculture, 1997. It's not a slouch outfit. This is another great study that was done. You can pull this up on the internet in your research. It's what's the name of these people? The Sonora, Mexico study, right? Done in the late 90s. They took, back in the 40s and 50s, when, you know, they had pretty much sold all their chemicals in California that they could, they moved south of the border and started selling the chemicals to the Mexicans, right? Because there's big agriculture down there, and they can grow a lot of food down in Mexico. It's warm a lot. And they said, well, let's get the Mexicans buying our chemicals and sell them on it. It's a new market for us. And of course, they found, and this particular group of Mexicans was indigenous. They were more Indian than they were Spanish, right? So there was a little valley, a little enclosed valley of very indigenous humans, meaning they were mostly Indians that had been there for centuries and centuries, way before the conquistadors, right? And so there was, you couldn't blame anything on mixed gene pools and all that, okay? This is a pretty finite gene pool. And that's what makes it so rare today, because everybody flies everywhere and everybody marries everybody else and they have kids, and it's hard to find a real pure gene pool anymore, which is a good thing. I mean, I'm not saying pure gene pools are bad. But in this case, it provided a great way for a real study where you took the gene pool thing out of the equation, right? And the chemical companies came down, and they had a big tribal meeting or whatever it was, these indigenous folks, and a lot of them didn't believe the gringos, and they said, we don't want to buy this stuff. We want to farm the way we've always farmed for centuries. We don't trust these people. Another group said, hey, they're promising bigger yields, no weeds, a lot less work. Less work and more yields. We like it. You know, there's always a group of people that appeals to them. There's always a group of people that doesn't appeal to them. They don't trust that method. It didn't sound right to them. Well, that went on. That was back in the 50s, and I think this is the third or fourth generation of babies since that original thing. And what happened is the people that didn't want it moved up into the foothills, and the people that did want to use the chemical stayed down in the valley. And after three or four generations, they tested the kids. The kids out from the outside looked normal. They laughed and they played just like all kids do. And these were 4 and 5 year olds. Then they did a series of tests, and the one that was really sort of stood out was they asked them to draw themselves. Just, you know, tell a 5 year old, 4 year, can you, they're always drawing, can you draw yourself? Requires some thought, you know. What am I? Here is the, up in the foothills, they stayed with their organic agriculture. Remember, organic is nothing new. Before 1940s, everybody did organic. And we lived and we had food. It's only after 1940 they've convinced us that there's no way we can feed everybody without chemicals. Yeah. And so up in the foothills, they had worse land. It wasn't as good a land as it was down in the bottom land near the river. And they tested the kids, and you can see the difference. The four-year-olds and the five-year-olds were able, they had a pretty good cognizance of the awareness of themselves. They had, you know, faces with eyes and noses and smiles. I mean, it's crude, but it's what about what you'd expect from a four- or five-year-old. Down in the valley, this is what you got when you ask them to draw themselves. They really had no idea. They just never thought of it, you know, or never, they had no, I don't know what that is in, scientifically, you know, but it was really blatant. There was something going on here. And the only difference was is the way they, what they ate. And the only difference in that is they ate the same exact foods. The only difference was one was grown with chemicals, one was grown organically without. Now, I don't know if this has reached your heads yet, but you and I, we're not in this group. We're in this group. And our kids are in this group. Now we'll move on from there. Huh?
The imagination is stifled.
The picture said, yeah, I don't know all the science behind those pictures, but I'm sure there's a lot, and it's not good. Yeah. Yeah, it has a latent effect, yeah.
There's no effect.
The rural people are finding out the hard way. Yeah. The information doesn't really make it to the cities. Yeah. But save those comments. Talk to me so we can, you know. Cover cropping. Now we're getting into the meat of it. I've left the little sales pitch, and now we're getting into the meat of it. Here's the question. Of these four pictures, which ground is ready to start a garden? Here they're trying to do something here, but what's the correct answer? Anybody?
Are they all ready?
No, they're not all ready. They're all not ready. The answer is none of them. if you just started a garden here and expected something to grow like this guy is, I mean, that's dead soil. There's no life in that, and you're going to have to, if you're going to get something to grow, you're going to have to put a lot of chemicals on it to get it to grow, because you're going to have a lot of weeds. You're going to be fighting a lot of weeds because the weeds are going to have control because it's depleted soil. They love depleted soil. They figured out a way to survive in depleted soil. These little onion plants, they like rich soil. So you're going to, in order to get those onions to grow, you're going to have to put a lot of fertilizer on there, make a lot of trips, and spend a lot of money on chemical fertilizers. You're going to have to spend money doing it organically too, but don't think you're going to get out of spending money. What?
What about horse manure?
Well, if you need horse manure, it's a good thing. If you don't need it, it's a bad thing. Okay. If you need it, if you got high potassium, I wouldn't put any manure on. This is buckwheat, and this is ready to start a garden. There's a guy, I don't know, I got that off the internet, but anyway, he's enjoying himself. but this is buckwheat. It's a really good cover crop. And it shades out the ground. They also call it a smother crop. But you can see that this ground is fertile. Those other grounds were dead, lifeless. Yeah. This ground is ready, rich, fertile. These leaves are feeding that soil biology with the sugars they exude out the roots. What do we call that?
Exudates,
but more precisely, root exudates.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. You're listening. Root exudates is pushing that easy sugar out the roots, feeding all that microbiology. So then when you cut this down and lightly till it in and make your beds, you're going to plant that plant, and it's going to have all that microbiology ready to help it out. Okay? And you don't have to spend so much on chemicals, and herbicides. Okay? Here's the farm at Gaia Garden. I took this picture. I'm always prouder of the pictures I took myself than the ones I robbed from the internet. You know? I took this picture, and here we are. We just took down this field, looked like this, just the morning, you know, earlier that day. And what we did is we mowed that in and tilled that in. I believe Daniel planted, he liked rye and, yeah, Orion oats or something like this. This is oats, winter oats. This is in the early spring. And we're getting ready to plant our summer crops, so we're having to mow this winter cover crop. It made it all through the winter, and now it's the spring, and it's starting to grow again. We mowed it down, and you can't see it in here, but there's legumes in here too. It's just they're a little bit lower than than the grass is. Remember, I always say mix the grass and legumes, or I'm going to tell you that. But you can see it once they, we didn't mow this down and throw it over in the woods. We mowed it down, chopped it up, and then tilled it into the soil. Now, that's the weak point of the cover crop. I'm going to get into the one weak point. Here it is again. This is Sudan grass. This is a summer cover crop. We're getting ready for our fall planting. So we had fall beds with this whole field. Remember, we did block rotations. We had a 5,000 square foot field. That's the difference between, that's a good thing on layout. Here's a 5,000 square foot block from here to here. We had 10 beds in that were 100 feet long. That's 20, 50 foot beds. And here was another same size right next to it, right? And so that's a good description of the layout. And here we're taking down Sudan grass, and see, it's all chopped up here. This thing here is called a flail mower. It's expensive, and it's not worth it for the home gardener unless you get, you know, where you're doing a few acres and you can make your money back on it, you know. But it's about this BCS tractor is one of those two-wheel tractors. You can put anything on the end of it, a mower, a tiller. You've got about 40 different implements you can put on the end of it. You can swing the handlebars from one side or the other. That helps, too. And you can offset the handlebars so you don't have to walk on the bed. You can walk in the walkway. That helps, too. But the flail mower is usually out of most home gardeners' reach because this is about anywhere from $4,000 to $8,000, depending on which one you get. They've got a few models. And this tool here is about $1,000. So roughly, you're spending about $6,000, $7,000 for this whole unit. Now that's what, oh no, I'm not going to do that. Okay, but that's the one weak point with cover crops is they get tall on you and your mower can't handle this. You're going to have to chop it down somehow by hand, and I have to do it by hand because I don't have one of these either.
Unless you get a sickle bar.
You could do sickle bars, but it's hard to till that in because it lays it down. It's a long thing. The flail mower chews it up. It chops it and chews it up, and it doesn't send it out to the side like a rotary mower, Yeah, rotary mower does. Yeah, bush hogs don't work as good because they just shoot everything out to the side, right? This just lays it down and mulches it right there. And then you come back in with a tiller and all that good green nitrogen-rich residue feeds your biology. It's fed your biology while it was growing, and now it's going to feed a whole different set of biology, breaking it down.
Can you hire these machines?
You might be able to rent them. I don't know. It's not at Home Depot or Lowe's, but that would be a good business to get in, is to rent these type of machines that are a little out of some people's reach. Because I know it is a pain, and I've thought about that. I thought, I've got an eighth of an acre now, and I thought, well, maybe I could do a quarter acre and still do my hedge method and then do my mulch mower, because I got to get it down a little bit before I can run my mower over it, right? And I thought, well, at some point, I'm going to have to invest in this. Because once you get too big and you have to do too much, you need a tool that can handle it. Yeah, I can't be out there hedging, you know, cover crop down so I can mow it. That takes too much time. I don't have that much time.
There is a mower out that you can cut different heights. You can cut it off the top and then go a little deeper and go a little deeper.
That might work. If it's a mulching mower and it doesn't ricochet it out the sides. Okay, good. Cover crops are essential to maintaining fertility by keeping soil microbes fed through its root exudates, right? We already talked about that. Keep soil in a cover crop anytime the cash crop is not being grown. So there's winter cover crops. Remember that? I don't have them anymore up there. You guys took them all, so I hope you have them. Remember that Peaceful Valley? They are the absolute kings. They do everything. They have tools and, you know, plants too. But they are absolutely kings in supplying cover crop. And they'll teach you all you want to know about cover crops. Well, this is not it. That was the irrigation one. But I'm saying the Peaceful Valley one that I had, that they're gone now. Peaceful Valley. You can get on the internet, find Peaceful Valley. I think it's groworganic.org or .com. Ask them for a catalog. They'll send you one for free. They sent me all these for free. Okay, if you didn't get one, they have all the good, everybody has cover crop, but they sell them and they have a huge, it's like their forte. They really explain it well, so you, the home grower, knows what, you can read all the material, and they sell small quantities. A lot of these guys don't want to sell anything less than a 20-pound bag. Well, you don't want to buy all that if you have a small place, you know. And so you want to keep, this is a winter cover crop, and look at that. This is vetch and barley. This is from my garden. I like vetch and barley for my own reasons. But you can see the frost on there, right? See the frost?
What's the first one?
Doesn't kill it.
Hairy vetch.
Hairy vetch, yep. It's expensive, but it does really well. It's one of the a little more pricier cover crop seeds, but it does really, really well. And it's a legume. It doesn't look like a bean, and you wouldn't eat the bean. It's a non-edible bean. But it is a legume. It takes nitrogen from the air, puts it down in the roots. And then when you get that when you till that in, you've got organic nitrogen. And it's a lot cheaper buying Hairy Vetch, even though it's a little pricier, than it is buying 50-pound bags of inorganic nitrogen. And you can get about 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And we're always going to talk in how many pounds per acre, even though you don't have an acre, yours is a lot smaller. Always think in 100, per acre. And then do the math and scale it down to your plot, okay? I got a little bit of a math lesson coming up, but you're going to have to be comfortable with divisional multiplication and division and all that. Your summer cover crops, see, this has got frost on it. It's not being killed. It stays green all winter long, feeding your biology all winter long, even in very cold climates. It can withstand it. Even under snow, it stays green. And it blankets and keeps it warm. It keeps that water dripping on it just at the right amount and not washing it out in a big flood, you know. Your summer crops are the same way. They're a whole different set of cover crops, but you have to make sure you're not putting on a winter cover crop in the summer and a summer crop in the winter because it won't grow. You got to get the right one for the season. But this is a warm season cover crop called Sudan grass. You can see he waited too long to cut this. This is a cool picture because he should have cut it when it was about this high. Instead, it's like 10 feet high there. But guess what, man? That machine took care of it. We were amazed. We thought, oh, this is even too tall for this machine. We're going to have to get somebody with a tractor out here, you know. And lo and behold, that machine, it took that down and chopped it all up. This is a good machine. So it's probably worth the $6,000 or $7,000 it costs. But it just shows you how tall that cover crop got. And, it only had a couple months to grow. It wasn't there very long. From seed to this tall. And what does that do? The grass, that's a grass. That's not. There's soybeans under there somewhere, but the grass is gives you biomass. Now, the only thing you're adding to your ground when you grow the legume is nitrogen. That is added. Everything else is just being recycled. You understand? You're not adding really anything else, except for carbon. You're adding carbon too. I don't care what you grow. You're taking carbon from the air and you're putting it in the soil. And that's really one of the reasons you're doing it, is you want to get more carbon into the soil. And this way you're not having to bag carbon into the soil with mulches and compost. You're creating, even when they told me not to put any more compost or manure on my crop because my potassium was too high, they still said it was okay to cover crop. Because what am I doing? I'm not adding any potassium that comes in with the bag stuffed. I'm adding just the carbon. And with the beans, I'm adding just nitrogen, two things I needed. But with bag stuff, you get the potassium with it. Okay? So that's why this is what you call growing your own compost and then recycling it back in the soil. And don't think you're adding anything. You're just taking nutrients that are already in the ground. They come up into the plant. You're turning them into something solid and above ground. And then you're putting them back in. But when they go back in, now they're complexed with carbon. And now, there are a lot, when something is complex with carbon, the beauty of carbon is, and why all living things, and I guess it's one of the things, all living things have carbon, anything that's living has carbon in it. The beauty of carbon is it'll hold on to stuff, and it'll let go at just the right time for the plant. So it doesn't hold on to stuff too tightly like rocks do and minerals do, you know what I mean? And it'll let go of the stuff it's holding on to, the ions it's holding on to when the plant wants it. It's a tight bond, it resists getting wind and flood erosion, but when the plant needs it, you can have it. And that's why you're complexing. Some of these nutrients were insoluble. They were attached to rocks, but this plant was able to work with the microbes, get it into their plant matter, complex it with carbon, then we till it back in, and now that iron, instead of being attached to a rock, is now attached to a humus colloid, and then the plant is able to access the iron now, where before it couldn't access it. So see how that helps the next crop? It's just amazing, cover cropping. Well, hold on. Talk after me. I got a lot of material to cover. Benefits of cover crop. Carbon capturing, nitrogen capturing with the legumes. You get carbon with both, legumes and grass. But the grass has the big root system. That's why you grow the grass, because they're really good at recycling the nutrients. Legumes are there to get the nitrogen from the air. Okay, that's why you grow them both together. They build humus. The nutrient availability is improved. We just discussed that. Beneficial microbes are supported. Not bad microbes, but beneficial microbes. The soil fertility is improved. Reduced wind and rain erosion. You know, you're not going to get much erosion from wind or rain when this is on your ground, okay? And that's a big nutrient loss. Nutrient recycling, you reduce your fertilizer inputs. And because if you can hold on, if I put a bag of calcium, you know, good calcium on, and I grow a cover crop after it, I'm going to hold on to that calcium. I'm going to hold on to that nitrogen. And it's not going to wash away with the first rain. Because a lot of those nutrients, you know, leach away. This is going to keep it from leaching away. Because the roots are going to capture it and send it back up into the above ground plant. And that's what you call it, recycling. Improved structure and aggregation and porosity of soil, all good things. Some of these roots go through the hard pan and break up your hard pan if you have it. I mean, they take care of so much stuff. Weed management, I mean, this, you're not going to get a lot of noxious weeds in this. This is your weed. It's like a hand-picked weed. It's like, let me pick my own weed. And let me pick a weed that's going to help me, and rather than a weed that really doesn't do a lot of good for me right now. So you're using, you're understanding nature, and you're kind of massaging it to your benefit. You're not taking over with chemicals. Like the chemical companies, they don't want nature. I mean, it's just, you buy our chemicals and don't bother yourself with trying to learn nature. You can't depend on nature. Use our chemicals and you can depend on it. We'll get you to your bottom line. I mean, that's their promise, right? You go this organic route, you start trying to figure out nature, anything could happen. Yeah, and that's one of their sales pitches. A lot of farmers believe it. Soil disease, if you grow a mustard cover crop, if you've got a lot of soil diseases, you know, you're getting funguses, soil-borne funguses, you can grow a mustard cover crop, and they actually act as a fumigant. And kind of fumigate it. Funguses, you know, bad funguses don't like mustard roots. And they get out of there. Soil diseases, increase water infiltration and reduce DOS, and on and on and on. I probably don't even have what all cover crops can do for you. This is, you know, people say, well, how do I become a good farmer? And I hope you didn't come in here thinking I was going to say, buy a bottle of this brown liquid and you will be an instant good farmer. Don't think you can, you know, there's going to be, when you get into this, there's going to be everybody trying to sell you something. I mean, even I'm going to try to sell you something, but but be very selective, and if anybody says, I'm not going to say what I'm going to give you is going to make you a great farmer. If anybody says this is all you need to be as a good farmer, then they're not telling you the truth. No bottle of liquid or no bag of powder is going to make you into an instant great farmer. You got to do a lot of little things well, which we're starting to cover here, And if somebody put a gun to my head and said, give me the one thing that's going to make me a great farmer, and they didn't accept the answer, like, you've got to do a lot of little things. If they didn't accept the answer and it was a gun to my head, I would say, cover crop. It's the closest thing. I know my own farming turned around when I learned about cover crops and I started growing cover crops and spending money on growing cover crops. I saw my ability to get a crop out of the ground go up about tenfold.
Wow. Amen.
So, cover crops are is the one magic bullet. I'm not even going to call it a magic bullet, but if you force me to say something was a magic bullet, I would say cover crop. But don't think it is, because just growing cover crops is not going to make you a great farmer, okay? But it is going to get you, probably going to give you a 3% advantage rather than 1%. The amazing winter cover crop. This is my own bed. You can see we had a bad, good snow that year for Atlanta. And you can see the green sticking out here. Didn't kill it. Right? It's nice, a nice blanket. And here I took a close-up shot. And see how the snow is just laying on top? It's not touching the ground. As it melts, it's dripping real nicely so it can infiltrate the ground and not wash away. You know, if it was sitting on the ground, it started melting and it was just, you know, it'd be too much water too soon. But drip, 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 because it's sitting up high, it lets it soak in better. You know what I mean? You get better infiltration that way. You don't get so much erosion. But it stays, the amazing thing is it stays green all winter. I was just amazed. You know, I thought everything died in the winter. Okay, 80% legumes. And here's the legume thing. Adds carbon and nitrogen, but you grow the legumes. Here's the hairy vetch, you know, little fern looking things. And I try to grow two or three legumes. I also mix in Austrian winter pea too. You want to get diversity. You know, nature is about diversity, not just growing one thing. Okay, so you're mixing it up with a grass and a legume, but if you can get away with it, grow two or three kinds of legumes, not just one legume, because it's going to give you more and different biology. You know how when you take a probiotic, you know, you ever buy probiotics at the store? And they're good for, I use them for a lot of things. Anytime people say take an antibiotic, I usually try the probiotic route first. And basically I'm following this thing. Why not saturate my body with positive bacteria rather than wiping out all bacteria? And let maybe the positive bacteria will take care of the bad bacteria that's infected me, right? So, why did I get off on that? Anyway.
Variety.
Yes, and thank you. When you go buy your probiotic, you always want to get the one that has the one that has the most strains and has the most numbers, right? And that's the same thing here. If you grow a diverse cover crop, you know, you might want to do two or three grasses, two or three legumes. I've just done two here because, you know, I'm still learning, but I want to get and branch out a little more the more I read. And you're going to get a whole different set of biology fed with a different legume, and maybe you get a little more nitrogen. But you can put on 100 pounds an acre of nitrogen with a hairy vetch cover crop. They fluctuate with how much nitrogen they can find. But a good stand, not a little pathetic stand, but a good stand of hairy vetch, you can guarantee you 100 pounds of nitrogen. Now, your crop might take, like brassicas like a lot of nitrogen, corn likes a lot of nitrogen. So it might not be all the nitrogen you need. You might have to put some manure on that's high in nitrogen, or some fish meal, or some feather meal, which is a protein form of organic nitrogen. You might have to subsidize that, but at least you get cheap nitrogen, 100 pounds of it, real good. Because I think with brassicas, I like to have about 200 pounds of nitrogen on there. And so I get half the way there with my cover crop. It's a lot cheaper than buying bags of feather meal. And then when you do legume, remember you got to buy the inoculant. Always buy, and there's certain inoculants that go with certain legume seeds. Okay, buy the right. Peaceful Valley will let you know what inoculant, but sometimes you have to remind them, oh, and I want the inoculant with that. It costs an extra $5. It's nothing. And I just shake it up, and here's my hairy vetch seeds, and I just pour it. It's like a black powder, and I usually pour a little buttermilk on it with a little water. Because, you know, it's bacteria rich, the buttermilk, and maybe put a little molasses in there and really get those bacteria loving it, you know, and then that helps them get started. You kind of put just enough water in there to coat the seed. You don't want it soupy wet, just a little drop or two, and then get that bacteria all over those seeds, and then I just broadcast them with my hand in my little garden. You know, you can't really put them in a mechanical seeder. That's the only problem with inoculation is you got to do a really fine little bit of water so you can use a mechanical broadcaster. Or if you get up this wet, I wasn't really worried about it because it was my home garden. I was just doing it by hand. I did the eighth of an acre by hand too. So you can do a lot of ground that way. And you got to get the application right. And see these? This is my hairy vetch. Now this is nothing to write home about. It's kind of skimpy, but you can see the nodules. I mean, I actually pulled that up and photographed it. These are full of the rhizobium bacteria, which you've inoculated your vetch seed with, and these are what help the plant fix nitrogen from the air. Those are full of billions of rhizobium bacteria, and the bacteria are actually able to work with the plant. They couldn't live without the plant, and a bean couldn't be a bean without rhizobium bacteria, and you couldn't eat the bean without rhizobium bacteria, right? And one helps the other. The plant helps the rhizobium helps the plant. And that what they help it do is fix nitrogen. If you don't have these nodules, you're not fixing nitrogen. And there's no point in growing a legume cover crop if you're not fixing nitrogen. Okay? If you have these nodules and you cut it open and it's not pink, it's not fixing nitrogen. There's something wrong. I don't want to get into all what could be wrong, but it should be pink on the inside when it's working. So you should have a lot of them, and they should be pink on the inside when you cut them open. Yep. Let me move on. Okay. Okay, the 20% grass. We already said root. You do the grass because they're better at recycling. They have massive root systems. Okay, and it does add carbon, and it complexes your recycled minerals with carbon, makes it easier for the next crop. Okay, blah, 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 yeah. All in moisture control and erosion control. We already got into that. But here you see a nice cover crop. I think this is, I grabbed off the internet. It was just nice. And they don't mow that. That's in between the beds. That's in the walkway. Now, I mow my walkways. I don't really spend the money to plant cover crops there, but some guys like to plant cover crops in the walkway, and they don't mow them because they want an insect barrier between their beds. I don't do it that way, but I've seen good farmers who are bring good stuff to market, do it that way. And that's one of their ways of not only erosion control in their walkways, but insect control. There's a barrier crop between their beds, a tall barrier crop. But, you know, I would worry about this going to seed, because sometimes if you let your cover crop go to seed, it becomes a weed. Okay, so I'm always concerned about, I don't want my cover crop to be something I can't get rid of. It just reseeds itself and I can't get rid of it. So I like to take them down before they seed. And I think these guys do that way too, because they don't want them to seed out either. But they like for them to grow tall. They don't cut it when it gets to looking a little shabby. They like to let it grow tall. Yeah, they walk in it. You can just walk on it. It doesn't really hurt it. You might. Maybe you could spray something that's organic, like pyrethrin, on your clothes or something. Yeah. Okay. That's true. I mean, you know, that's the point. Maybe you just mow it then.
Doesn't your vetch throw out the seeds right early on?
Huh?
The vetch that you're putting on? My legume with the grass?
Yeah.
You said the vetch.
Yeah, it's vetch and it's vetch and it's legume. I throw out the grass first, and then I throw out the vetch seed first. And remember, I thought maybe I'd do later. But in order to get 20% grass to germinate, you know, it says, oh, put 100 pounds of this seed on per acre. Well, I got to scale that down and do the math and say, well, how many pounds do I need for, or how many ounces do I need, or how many grams sometimes do I need for my little plot, right? I scale that down, I do the math, and then I'm putting the apparate I'm using is 100 pounds per acre. It's easy just to talk in those terms. Everybody uses them, okay? So just get comfortable with doing the math and scaling it down. And talk and say, well, I put on, if somebody asks you, how many seeds did you put on? Well, even though you only put maybe on 5 ounces because you got a little plot, say, oh, I put on 100 pounds an acre. And they're like, well, how much land do you have? You know? I only got 400 square feet. And you put on, yeah, you're like, do the math, you know. What I was going to do, I want 80% legumes, because I'm mostly interested in that nitrogen, and I don't want it to be all grass, I just want 20% grass. That's enough. That's kind of there's a book out there called, I'll give it to you later. I think I have it on my book list. But it'll go over this. And then in order to get that, because I'm not, real farmers go out there and they have seeding equipment and they'll drill the cover crop in. And it goes in, every seed goes in at the right depth and it's all mechanical. And if you know, most of us don't have that. But so what I have to do is I just go out there and broadcast it. And then you can't just leave it laying on top of the ground. It won't germinate. You got to go out there with a rake and kind of rake it in, you know, just back and forth, just kind of lightly rake it in, so you get some of it gets covered up with the dirt, and they germinate and grow really well. And you water it in and keep it watered until it germinates, you know, don't let it dry out. And you wait till it starts poking up. And the reason is, in order to get 20% grass, this is what I was trying to get to, you got to put on like a 50% app rate when you're just broadcasting. If you're drilling and you got all that equipment, then just put on 20% of the app rate. But if you're broadcasting and raking, you're not going to get real great germination, so you got to make up for that by putting on a little bit extra. So usually, in my experience, and I've kind of played around with these numbers, if I put on 50% of the app rate, or maybe 40, because grass is usually quick to grow. It'll come up first. Or maybe even, you know, like 40% of the app rate. I think I'm going to back off of 50 and put on 40% of the app rate, and you'll get about 20% to germinate and grow. And that's what you want. You want that 20% germination. Legumes, I want 80%. I usually double that. I put on 160%. So whatever 80% is, I see what 100% app rate is. Then I back off of that 80%, and then I double it. I'm probably a simpler way to do that, but that's the way I do it.
So do you never harvest those cover crops?
Nope. You mow them down and till them in. Yeah, I don't harvest them for grains or anything like that. No, I just... but then you defeat the purpose. You know, you're growing a cash crop. These are cover crops. They're meant to be sacrificial. That's there, huh? Yeah, to add to the fertility of the soil. If you're growing a cash crop, grow it in your grow beds. You know, or well, I shouldn't say that because you're growing a cover crop in the grow beds. But if you're growing it's not a cash crop. It's a cover crop. It's a soil building crop.
Unless you got a large acre, you want to plant large fields.
Well, the thing is that. Thought just went out of my head, but it's a soil building crop. I know what it was. Sometimes they call it green manure. You ever heard of that word? Oh, that's green manure. Well, that's just sort of it's green manure is a cover crop, but it's specifically for tilling in. and enriching the soil. That's why I call it a green manure crop. A cover crop would probably be something like just growing buckwheat. Buckwheat, it doesn't have a big root system. It's not a legume. It doesn't give you nitrogen, but it does do one good thing. It grows really quick and has big broad leaves, and it shades out the ground, so you don't get any, you know, it grows quicker than the weeds do. It shades them out so you don't get any other competition weeds. It's not a nauseous weed because it dies really easy, you know, and it doesn't have a big old root system. And so they call that a smother crop when you're growing it for controlling weeds, because you're smothering out any of the weeds, right? If you do it for when you let it go to flower, you're going to attract good insects, because wasps love that little white flower they put out, and it looks really pretty, and bees love it. If you ever let a crop of buckwheat go to flowers, go out there early in the morning, because bees, that's when bees are active, early in the morning, you'll be standing out there and it'll just be this, you know, and it's just early in a sunrise when the dew's still on there and everything's just so bright green, and you hear this, and you're like, I don't know, it gives me tingles. It gives me tingles just talking about it, because it's like a magical, I won't say magical, it's like a blessed moment, okay?
A year in advance or something? You gotta grow that cover crop like that a year in advance.
No, this is grown in the winter or in the summer between cash crops. You either have cool season cash crops or warm season cash crops. If you got a cool season cash crop, you're always gonna grow a winter cover crop. But you know, but if you're growing a summer cash crop, you don't have to grow a summer cover crop there. But if you're growing if it's a winter bed, if you designated a cool season bed, then you're going to, about May or June in my area, I till up my spring vegetables and I plant my summer cover crop, and it grows from like July, and I start thinking about taking it down in like first August, because I want to give it. That's the other thing. Hopefully, I get into is when you take it down. You got to take it down about 4 weeks before you decide to plant. Because when you take it out and till it in, those microbes aren't going to be interested in your little plant and helping your little plant out. They're going to be interested in breaking down all that plant material you just tilled in. And your plants will suffer if you put the plants in too soon after the cover crop. Okay, you need to wait about 4 weeks. Okay? Some people say two, some people say six, but I always use four, huh?
If we longer get cooler weather?
Yep. Decomposition is slower down in cooler weather. So you're going to, all this is, I'm kind of giving you from the Southeast Georgia perspective. You're a different area. The principles still apply, but your timing will be a little different. And some things you might not get away with. You might have to go to plan B. But go to localharvest.org, go to a guy who's a local organic farmer doing it for a living, and say, hey, what do you do? And just copy him. They've got it worked out for your area, you know. These are winter legumes. You got vetch, you got Austrian winter pea, you got crimson clover. Crimson clover doesn't grow on my ground. I've tried it because I love the little flower. I want to see it, but I can't get it to grow. So don't beat your head. You know, if this doesn't grow in your soil for some reason, I haven't figured out why it doesn't grow. Grow what does work. Vetch works in my soil and pea works in my soil. So those are the two I grow. I don't waste any more money, I should say, on trying to grow crimson clover. Do what works. Don't beat yourself up trying to do something you heard about in some book, you know? I had some people come up to me and say, I want to grow a lemon tree in Kentucky. I said, well, I saw a guy doing it in a greenhouse. I'm like, do you have a greenhouse? No. Do you know how to grow? Do you have any expertise in botany or growing things out of season, way out of climate like that? No. Well, then why don't you try growing something you can grow in your area? Why would you want to do the hardest thing? I mean, I'm sure somebody who's really good at their craft can grow a lemon tree in Kentucky in a greenhouse, and it's beautiful. If you're just beginning, I'd grow with what works and not with what is probably going to fail, you know? Yeah, move to Florida. That's the other option. You know, pick the right species and do what works. Don't try to grow the weird thing. Grow the thing that works. I mean, I'd rather have food than saying, well, I grew a lemon tree in Kentucky, you know, and I got lemons. Well, okay, but you don't have a lot else because you spent all your time trying to get the lemon tree to grow, you know. This is medic. It's another winter cover crop. Then here's my barley in the winter, and then there's a wheat crop, and you got rye, and you got oats as your winter grasses. For some odd reason, and this seems really counterintuitive to me, there's a lot more variety in your winter cover crops than there is in your summer. It seems like, you know, summer we'd have more variety in your cover crops. But for some reason, you're really kind of limited in your I mean, I think these are the only four legumes there are. I mean, I had more pictures I could have put up with winter cover crops. But soybean is a winter cover crop. Now, when you're going to the cover crop, you don't let it go to the bean. Why not? Because then all your nitrogen is in that bean, and it's more locked up. You want to take that soybean down when it's still, before, as it's starting to blossom. And then you want to take it down, because that all, then all the nitrogen is still down in the ground in the roots before it gets all bound up in the bean. Okay, now if you're going for a cash crop, of course, you know, that's a cash crop. You're not growing it for a cover crop. So you want to knock these down. And what they say to do is, when you see the flower, when you start to see flower, you want to take it down before it seeds out. Okay, that way you get the maximum use out of the crop. Now the problem is, a lot of times in my spring, if I'm going to plant in April 7th, I got to mow that down March 7th, like 4 weeks before, and it hadn't started a flower yet. That's the problem I run into. And when that happens, you just bite the bullet and mow it and let that decomposition. You don't want to have to sit there and wait and wait and wait for the flower. It would be nice if it did, but the worst of the two wrongs is, you know, letting it go to flower and then having to wait and lose your window of planting your crop because you're still waiting for the decomposition to happen. You know what I mean? So it's ideal to mow it down when you see the legume or whatever flower. The grass isn't going to flower first. When you see the legume start to flower, when you see about 25 to 50% flower rate, not everything flowering, and then you'll probably be past it, then you take it down or sooner. I'll say it that way. These are your specialty cover crops, mustard and buckwheat. That's a biofumigant, beneficial, and lots of grooved insects love that little mustard flower, okay? But you got to be starting to think about taking it down because you don't want it to go to seed, and now you have a weed problem with mustards, okay? So your timing has got to be spot on. That's why, you know, you can't really just go on vacation and come back 2 weeks later. You might have missed your window. Now your mustard, which was a big old help because you didn't take it down soon enough, now it's become a weed problem. Because it's reseeded itself. So that's why you know, this stuff, I mean, I don't want to put you off or say, I'm just not going to do it, you know. But you know, it's fun when you get into it, you know, and you start learning how things work, and they work for you, and you're not, you know, things start growing, and you have start having fertility, and you start being grow things when you couldn't grow them before, and you're thinking, and you get enraptured with it, you know. You're like, wow, this is just nature at work, and it's so amazing. And once you know a few little things, you're a better farmer. Buckwheat, we've already went over that. It's a smother crop and it's sort of a specialty crop. Problem, okay, here's the thing. The problem with trying to grow a winter cover crop in a cool season bed is you have the overlap. You're having to get the cover crop in the ground at the same time your cool crop is just starting to come to maturity. So what do? And I do what you call intercropping. You see, I got my mustard, or I don't know what this is, mustard, I planted them from transplants. I think they're collards or something. But you see, this is my cover crop grass seed there. You can't really see the legumes because they're dark and they sort of blend in with the soil. But you can see the grass seed. So what I do is I just throw them on there and then I'll go in between the rows and sort of cultivate them in. And because I've let this cash crop get a little further ahead, you know, the cover crop sort of grows behind it. And I'm able to, you know, harvest this, and then when this is gone or the cold takes it out, the cash crop is right behind it, right, you know, there. Because what happens is if you don't get your cover, and especially on the winter cover crops, if you don't get it on before it gets really cold, it won't germinate. So you got, I'm in my area, my window is the first week of October. I have to get my winter cover crop on the first week of October. If I wait a week later, I don't get half the stand I do when I do the first week of October. You know what I mean? Because it's already starting to get cold enough, unless I have some sort of freak weather going on, it's already starting to get cold enough where I don't get the germination I did when I did it the first week of October. Because they'll live through the winter, we saw it living through the snow there, but they won't germinate when it gets a certain temperature. So you need to get them on early enough so they'll germinate and get about knee high, and or, you know, at least shin high before the winter, cold winter hits. And then they'll make it. But don't expect them to make it. One time I was helping somebody out, and we sowed the first week of November. And we thought, well, it might be a waste. But we got a little bit of a stand, but it was anemic compared to what I do in the first week of October. So you really want a good, lush stand. So what you have to do in with the fall season, these mustard beds are cool season beds, and you can see I timed this one just right. Sometimes I don't get it on right, and if I let these get too tall, they shade out and they don't germinate because they don't get any sun. They don't grow because they don't get any sun. And then when the cold takes these out, I mean, they're cool season crops, but at a certain temperature, they do die. okay? But if I wait and let these things get too big, then I don't get the growth here, and I get a weak stand. I got them on in time. Well, I didn't get them on in time because I let these plants get too big. If these plants are too small, then the cover crop overtakes the cash crop. It's a fine balance there that you might screw it up the first couple times you do it, but keep at it and you'll get better at it. This is a dead of winter broccoli field. Broccoli's a cool season crop, and you can see all the broccoli's dead or been harvested, but you can see the cover crop is growing. It was undersown right, like I'm doing here, is there to protect the ground through the winter because it was sown just at the right time. And that's a bit of a tricky, overlapping that, getting cover crop growing in those cool season beds. There's the inoculant. I wanted to provide a picture with the inoculant. It comes in little plastic bags, and you don't need much. A little bit of inoculant. I mean, bacteria are super small, so a little bit of that bacteria will, and you can't use too much of it, of the inoculant, okay? So don't worry. I don't use and like to store it. I just, even though it could, I could do lots of seeds with it, I just dump it all in there. And
you can use that inoculant and add those other things you were mentioning before, the buttermilk and the, you were adding that too.
Yeah, you don't have to do that.
Okay.
You just make sure when you put the water in the inoculant to let it stick. You don't put too much water in. You don't want it soupy. You just want it kind of be able to stick to the seeds. And the other thing you got to be really careful with is you don't use chlorinated water. you don't use tap water. You either got to use rainwater or distilled water or, something without the, because chlorine kills microbes, okay? Yeah. So I got a rain barrel. I collect rain, and I use that for a lot of stuff. Go ahead. What's that?
Is it best to collect the rainwater?
Well, that's an irrigation. That's another topic, but I'll say this real quick. Don't think that you can water your garden, even a small garden, with rainwater. You'd have to buy big old... It's unbelievable how much water it takes to water a garden, especially if you get 2 weeks of no rain. You can make it 1 week maybe with no rain, but after a week of no rain, you're having to start to irrigate. And I mean, plants like about an inch of water a week. Now, some like a little more, some like a little less, but just average about an inch a week, and you don't apply a whole inch at the same one time. You kind of break that up into two waterings in the week or three waterings in the week, and I'm telling you, I got a 300 gallon tank, and I got two 300 gallon tanks, and one 300 gallon tank of rainwater that I collect might last me in my little 400 square foot garden, might last me a couple weeks if I'm frugal, and I'm careful. So if I get a 6 week drought, what I do is, this is irrigation, but I'm going to give it to you. What I do is I fill my 300 gallon tank, and then I treat it with that AquaChem, the stuff you do with fish aquariums, and now it takes out the chlorine. It also takes out the ammonia, which I don't like. I like ammonia, but it takes out the chlorine, and I just have to sort of beef up the some of my ammonium sulfate fertilizers, to compensate for it taking out the ammonia. But it takes out the chlorine, and I get algae growing in my tank, where before just tap water wouldn't grow algae because of all the chlorine in it. And now the other thing on that is, you say, well, I can just leave it in the open and it'll evaporate off. Chlorine's pretty volatile. It'll just leave the water after. If you shake the water or spray the water, it just evaporates or goes. It volatilizes, go up in the atmosphere. But now most of your municipal water supplies, if you're on county water, they're adding this thing called chloramine. You ever heard of that? Chloramine is a stable form of chlorine. They attach it with an ammonia, not an ammonia atom, what is it? Anyways, it's an ammonia compound, and that stabilizes it, and it doesn't leave the water for 3 or 4 months. It doesn't break down for 3 or 4 months, huh? Chloramine, which is what they're adding to water now. They used to not do that. This is kind of a last 10, 12 years they started doing that. So you really can't just let it evaporate like you used to could. First you broadcast it, timing, different variety, have the right season and all that, and the one that grows 80-20 mix, and get your timing right. Then you bury it, and you can bury it with a little cultivator or rake. You're raking it in, and if you got this equipment, you can lightly till it in, lightly, just set it really light so it doesn't go too deep. You don't want to bury that seed too deep. You just want to lightly, just under the surface, okay? I like just raking it. I mean, if you don't have a huge place, you can just rake a lot of ground really fast. It doesn't take long. Then you want to keep it watered. Remember, once you start the germination process, you've got to keep water on it until it gets at least an inch high, and you can back off. You can start backing off when it emerges, but then you really want to make sure it doesn't have to fight too hard. You know, hot sunny days are really hard on it when it's an infant, just like a little baby. You know, you got to really care for it when it's really small. And then as it gets bigger, it's on its own and it can fend for itself, you know. But you can water with these watering wands. They're really nice. Dram makes the best ones. These tripod sprinklers are great because you can't drip or cover crop is a broadcast thing, so you can't drip line it. Okay, it doesn't really work with drip lines. It's not done in rows. It's broadcast everywhere. So these are really nice because these tripod reciprocating sprinklers, because you can just plug the hose in down there, and there's a hose plugged in here on these, and it stands sort of above it. And so you can water things, and you're not worried about weeds because the cover crop is going to... I don't do this on my cash crops, just on my cover crops. Okay? And you can always do it by hand if your garden's small enough. Then you grow it. Once you've watered and it's germinated, then you can back off and you can let your cover crop fend for itself. I'm not saying you have to baby it the whole time. Just the initial phases, okay? And then you can back off, and you want a lush carpet of 80% legume, 20% grass, and here's a hard frost, killed everything else, but didn't kill the cover crop. And I had a nice green carpet on my soil. Nature never leaves bare soil. It always tries to cover it. And you're just trying to emulate that, but you're trying to just pick a beneficial weed that's going to help you. There's my mother in our little 400 square foot. I got, you know, 4-foot wide beds, 400 square foot garden. When you add it all up, she's standing in the walkway, and we've just mowed. you see the head shears in her hand? I got, you know, she's getting older, and she gets out there and gets her exercise in. It wears her out. But she loves her garden, you know. This has brought me and my mother together, you know, really together. We get out there and we have a common bond now, you know. We're not two generations fighting each other, you know. We have a goal together, you know. I got her hedged. See how this is getting hedged down here? Because I don't have that nice equipment, I have to use my mower, my mulching mower. I don't have a bag on that. I'm just going to mulch it right in. But, you know, I found out that my mower works better if I bag it and then just redump it on the thing. The mulching part doesn't work as good, and it's a little extra step. And I wish, for some reason, I think they do make mowers out there. You don't have to bag it. It'll just mulch it, you know, and leave it there if you don't have a bag on it. And see, it's a rear discharge. You don't want a side discharge where you have a bag, like, hitting everything on the side. Most of them are rear discharge now. But she had to hack it down to this height with the head shears before I could mow it, because I can't mow something this tall. It just bogs down my little mower. But it works if you don't have too much.
You can't raise the adjustment of the weed.
Yeah, I raised it to the highest setting, and it still bogs it down. And then once you mow it, this is freshly tilled in. And see how clumpy and lumpy that looks and sort of trashy that looks? Well, if your biology is working in 4 weeks' time, you'll be ready to plant. Now, you won't be able, now if it's a transplant, you usually don't have to go back over there and till. But if you're trying to do direct seed stuff like radishes and arugula and stuff like that, or beans, then you'll have to come back in here and lightly till it to get some of those clumps out. And then rake it nice and get some of the clods out, you know, and make it look really nice, like a good clean seed bed. But if you're doing transplants, I maybe run over it once with a tiller. I don't do it too much, because you really don't have to be that particular with transplants, which is another good reason to grow transplants. You spend less time driving heavy equipment across your soil, right? And that's the end of that one. Okay, soil structure. You ready? Okay, this is about my first slide on soil structure, and we're kind of covering, we're lumping this in with the elements and all this stuff. This is, you'll never find this on the internet or any chart. I made this up. It kind of helped me understand what was going on. And every once in a while, I have to refer to it so I can just burn it into my brain again. And I got that copied on one of my handouts. These are inside the box are things you have some control over as a farmer. They're things that you can manage. The things outside the box are things that really you can't manage. You can't manage insect pressure. You get the insects when they come. You can't manage weed pressure. I mean, certain things you do inside the box can affect weed pressure, but they're going to come at you. You know what I mean? You don't have any control over the wind or over the barometric pressure or over the sunlight, temperature, humidity, water. You don't control the rain. God controls everything outside the box. Well, and he does to some extent control things in it. He set it up inside the box. But this is the things you have, he's allowing you to manage a little bit more, right? And so kind of think of it that way. And if you manage the things inside the box well, then these things that come at you outside the box don't affect you so much. If you manage inside the box well, you don't get the weed pressure coming at you like you did. You don't get the insect pressure coming at you did. Man-made pressure, I'm not sure what I meant by that, but you know, when we tar over fields and build subdivisions and stuff like that, in a way, if you manage this correctly, whoever you're leasing land from might not want to sell that land to the subdivision developer. He might want to keep it as a nice farm. So, you know, if you do this well and you have a nice, if you have an ugly farm that is just sitting there, they might say, just sell that son of a gun and let's get the money out of it and build houses. So you do have effect on that somewhat. And you can record these things, and it can help you manage this better. You can record cloudy days versus sunny days. When you have wind. Wind is something every plant needs wind. Too much wind is a bad thing, but with no wind, you don't get a corn crop. Wind actually, and corn waving and wheat waving in the wind, is the muscle that helps send some of those nutrients up into the head. Okay? They, there's a joke about that, but I won't tell it. It's too long, but... everybody's complaining about the weather. You know, when farmers get together, it's like, oh, it's not my fault, it's the weather. And God says, well, tell me what you want, and I'll deliver the perfect weather for you. Just tell me what you want. So they, okay. So they tell them the perfect weather, and the sun's just right, and the temperature's just right, and the rain's just right. And they come out there, and their corn's looking really beautiful, and it's tall as it's ever been, and it's as green as it's ever been. And they go in there to harvest. Nobody went in. Everything was looking so good from the outside. That's another thing. They never went and checked their crop. They just looked at it from the window of the car, you know. And they go in there and there's no corn. They're like, what? God, what happened? You gave us everything perfect. What did we do wrong? He said, you didn't ask for wind. Wind is something that, you know, helps a lot of crops do their thing. And see, we don't really realize these things because we're always fighting nature, you know, trying to, you know, we live in our little metal cocoons in our car, and we live in our houses with our brick walls, and nature is out there, and we're in here where it's nice, in our controlled environment. But plants are always out in nature, and they've learned to, you know, they're the magnetic flux under the ground, the wind, the barometric pressure, all this is, the plants are very sensitive to. And just because you're not sensitive to it, doesn't mean the plant isn't aware of it. And you need to, if you're going to grow things, become the ball, you know, like the Caddyshack thing. But you got to become the plant. You know, the plant doesn't care what you call yourself. He doesn't care that you're an Adventist. That plant does, and you're the remnant church. It could care less. The plant doesn't care if you're organic and you feed the poor with all your produce. The plant could care less. The plant's only trying to survive, and it has to encounter all these things, and you're helping it survive by your efforts combining with nature. Okay, so just sort of burn, and the triangle in here is the Albrecht method. He focuses on chemistry. Elaine Ingham, he's dead, but they got their disciples out there that think Albrecht is king, and he's a good guy, and he got dismissed. He lost his tenure from the University of Missouri because he wouldn't get on the chemical bandwagon. And you don't lose your tenure, do you?
It can happen,
but it doesn't usually happen. It's a weird, weird thing. So everybody thought he was just great. And then when he didn't change over to the chemical back in the late 40s or in the 50s, when he didn't change over, they just dismissed him, and he lost his tenure because he didn't go along with it. He says, you're going to ruin your soils doing this. Nobody listened to him. The university said, hey, the corporations are giving us X amount of dollars. We're going with it. If you're not on board, see you later. You know, it's the money. You know, what does Deep Brother say? Follow the money. And anyways, that's William Albrecht, and a lot of guys still, he's dead, but a lot of guys still promote him. Neil Kinsey, the guy here, I don't know, the bag and some of his literature, that's International Ag Labs. International Ag Labs follows the Reams method. They focus on the energy. It's kind of like physics. It's talking about you got to have ionic exchange. It's just not about the chemistry. It's what the chemistry does. The plant doesn't live off nitrogen. The plant lives off the chemical reaction the nitrogen produces. And that's the energy. And I kind of think that takes it a little bit beyond chemistry. I mean, it does talk about chemistry and biology, but it says the energy is kind of the most important leg of this triangle. I don't really think there's a really important leg. I think it's all three equal, like a fire triangle. But, you know, you get into these guys, and this is what we are left with. Now, some guys try to marry them all together. And there's soil labs, that CSI lab, he tries to marry it all together. But guys that are in the Reams, they think energy is the most important leg. Guys that are into Albrecht think chemistry is the most important leg. And people that are into Elaine Ingham, who's still living, you can go and take her classes out in Oregon, and she'll give you a microbiology class and do a microscope with it. You can count your own biology. That's what she believes. You don't have to put on chemistry. You don't have to worry about this. If you've got your biology right, and this might appeal to Adventists who don't want to do, you know, or anybody who doesn't want to do any work. She says, if you can do your biology right, they'll take care of the industry, and every soil has everything you need if you have the right biology. That's her take. Now, some of these guys say, that's impossible. You know, if you don't have calcium, there's no microbe that's going to generate calcium. It has to be there for the microbe to work with. I don't know. This sounds very promising, and I've heard Elaine Ingham speak, and she's a really neat lady. One of the books on my book list, a guy kind of dumbed her down in layman's terms so we can understand her, because when she speaks, she's very understandable. But when she writes, whew, you can't understand any of it. It's way over my head real quick. But they have a lawyer guy who is a gardener, and he was used to making things simple for juries. You know, lawyers have a certain knack for that. And he took her stuff, and because he was already a gardener, he was able to dumb it down so most of us can understand her, you know. And so it's on the book list. It's the first book I recommend, is the guy who wrote that book. And then, of course, some people think tillage is part of that triangle. I kind of keep tillage on the outside because the physics, the physical world, some people put physical here, but the physical world talks about tillage, you know. I like to put the energy there, and that is physics. Electricity is physics. And I put the tillage out here, kind of surrounding it, because that affects all of this. Okay, but yeah, and you have some control over that. Anyway, I think it's helped me a lot. Maybe it'll help you. This is the perfect soil, and you have to manage the humus. Now look, sometimes it's called organic matter, sometimes it's called humus. I think there's a difference. To me, organic matter is, you go from mulch to humus, which, you know, mulch is like a leaf you can distinguish. Humus is like that black coffee grounds you can't distinguish, right? And it's the good stuff, right? Mulch is good too, but it's not good for tilling in your soil because the plants can't use a buried leaf. It takes time to break that down, right? So if you put on humus into your soil, or you build humus into your soil, some people call it organic matter. But to me, organic matter is between mulch and humus. And you don't really want a lot of that in your soil. You know, stuff that's partially broken down. To me, that's the sort of in-between stage. Anyway, on this one, let's just say that's humus. And you've got your parent material, which is from your bedrock. That's mineral. Somebody was telling me somebody wants to grow in all compost. And I have people down in Georgia that think compost and wood chips are king. It's not. This is the perfect soil. Sand, silt, or clay, and 5% humus. It's hard to keep 5%. It takes a long time to build up humus in the soil. Because even if you dump it on, or even you do cover crops, If you don't manage it right, you're losing it really fast, because that's called the carbon cycle. Remember I talked about the carbon cycle? And you, as a farmer, everything cycles, but carbon and nitrogen are the two things that go from gas to a solid. Gas to a solid. Gas to a solid. Real quick. And you want to try to get it to hang out in the solid state in your soil as much as possible. But you're not going to get it to hang out there forever, so that's why you got to manage well. You just want to try to elongate the time it hangs out there. So if you can build 5% humus in your soil, good quality humus, not chipped up bark, but good broken down humus, you're going to have perfect soil. And you're going to have the biology and the pore space that builds the pore space in your structure to have 25% air and 25% water inside those pore spaces. Okay? That's perfect soil. And it's not all wood chips, okay? Okay, this is going to break it down. When you look at a handful of dirt, what are you looking at? Well, the inorganic part, and I'm talking as a chemist here, inorganic part doesn't have any carbon attached to it. It's just from the bedrock material, right? Or blown in from somewhere else, or lava flowed down a mountain. The bedrock rock, the inorganic material, the mineral, I guess you could call it too, is you got three sizes. Really doesn't matter what constructs them, but you got three sizes. You got sand, which is like Jupiter. You got silt, which is like, I don't know, Venus, Earth, I guess. And you got clay, which is like Pluto. Okay. And then that's called your soil texture. And then out here, even finer than clay, is the clay colloid. Or let's just call it a mineral colloid. Okay? And some people think clay, I always thought clay should be the biggest one because I see clods of clay out there and I think, wow, it's big, you know. But clay's just packed together little minute little particles. Okay? Clay's not always bad. Clay can actually hold on to things better than sand can. You know what I mean? People that have sandy soils have to fertilize a lot more frequently in little amounts because everything washes out of sand. And sand doesn't really hold on to stuff. You know, it doesn't attract nutrients. You know, it doesn't bind nutrients. Clay holds on to water, holds on to nutrients, and you don't have to fertilize as often. And once you get your soils perfect, they stay perfect with clay soils. So don't think clay is always bad. It's not always bad. Sometimes, huh? I don't have that, so I'm not really familiar, but I've heard that term a lot, gumbo soil, yeah. It's more like silt, isn't it?
It's like clay bound up. You can't, it's not very good.
But you can work with gumbo, because I hear the guys talk about that. Well, what I've always read and I've always heard, I do add sand to my clay a little bit because I don't have a lot of sand, but you really can't, you got to play the hand that's dealt you when it comes to soil texture. You really can't change that. You can add a few things, and it doesn't hurt, but you're really not going to change it that much, you know. The way you help this out is by working with the soil structure, and we'll get to that. But right now, isn't this make it simple? Half of that 45% mineral content is either sand, silt, or clay, or a colloid. This is the best part. This is the part that'll release nutrients quicker than any of these other three, right? This is what you want in your soil, and you're dealt with that. It's like, I give you the size here, whatever that is, 0.000 millimeter. But this is the part also, well, let's go next, and then I'll talk about it. Now, on the organic side, things that used to be alive and are now dead, right? And why are they organic? Because they've got carbon attached to it, right? Carbon makes it organic in a chemical sense. You've got mulch. Now, we can look at that and say, oh, that's a leaf. And that's mulch, and that has a purpose. You know, we can use mulch. Then you've got organic matter, which now it's sort of in between this and this, right? It's starting to get broke down. You can kind of, you can tell there's been some decomposition, but you can still say, well, that's a little stick, and that's a little piece of bark, and that's a little piece of leaf. You can kind of, but there's been a lot of decomposition. That's what I call organic matter, or litter. Some people call it litter. And then you go from that, it breaks down to that, and then you go to humus. And that's sort of the holy grail. And really, there's one past that, and that's called the humic colloid. And those little dots on the inert side, and especially on this can hold 10 times more nutrients than that little inert colloid. Okay? And 1 pound of carbon can hold 4 pounds of water. So carbon, the beauty thing about carbon is its ability to hold water. That's why you want it in your soil. But if you get too much of it, like people who think they can grow in just pure compost, you're going to have too much water, and you're going to have some diseases that love a lot. You're going to have waterlogged soils, okay? So there's balance here in everything. You just don't think, well, it's good now, more of it's better. You know, the more better kind of syndrome. Sometimes more is worse than having too little, because you can always add to your soil. It's hard to take stuff out of it once it's there. So sometimes having not enough is better than having too much, just because you can deal with it. So I'd rather creep up to a limit that I'm an area that I'm looking for, than having to try to back off, because it's really hard to take stuff out of the soil without screwing up a lot of other stuff, you know. But the colloid is the thing. It's so small and it's so light. A colloid, everybody know the definition of colloid? It can stay suspended for a long time in water. It's so light that normally when things like that settle out, this will stay suspended. And a mineral colloid, and they'll also get blown away in the wind. So this, the best part of your soil on the inorganic side and on the organic side is these colloids, and they're the first thing to leave. You know, you can hold on to mulch, you can hold on to this stuff, it won't blow away or wash away too bad, but this stuff, when it rains, it gets dissolved and it's flowing down your gully, you know, if you don't have a cover crop. And or if you're tilling when it's really dry, it's blowing away in the wind. You've seen those dust clouds when people till and there's dust all around the tractor. You can't even see the tractor sometimes. There's so much dust around. Well, you know, sometimes you're forced to do things because there's a drought. You know, what are you going to do? But, you know, that's when you want to time your stuff right. So you want to till, you know, not when it's really wet. That's bad too. But just in the right time you want to till so you don't get a lot of dust and you're not forming a lot of clods when it's too wet. Okay? So that's the organic. Now, isn't that simple? Here you're looking at dirt and that's the only two categories dirt falls in. It either doesn't have a carbon on it and it's inorganic, or it has a carbon on it and it's organic. And then you break that down into size. Sand's big, silt's a little smaller. You find silt in the bottom of creek beds and river beds. That's silt. It's a little smaller. And clay is the smallest thing of all. And then, clay's even smaller and the colloid's even smaller. Here you have four sizes too, but they're just organic. They have carbon. Simple, right? I mean, that really, I don't know if you guys already knew that, but when I learned that, I mean, all of a sudden, everything sort of made a lot more sense. Now, when I look at soil, I can say, well, it could either be rocks or something that used to be living. And then I just got various sizes in here, right? This is called the soil texture triangle, and this is in all your books, and it's pretty easy to read, and you can do this by ribboning, or there's what ribboning is probably, right? Ribboning, and you can kind of tell what your soil is. And you're not really going to change it. I mean, you could go out there and throw bags of sand when you don't have sand, or bags of clay when all you got is sand. But you're really not going to change it that much. You kind of have to play this hand you're dealt with. You can't really affect your soil texture, but you can work with it. And you can turn any soil into some good soil with organic matter and biology, microbiology. So anyways, how do you know if you have 50%? You'll hear somebody, he said a gumbo. Well, that's gumbo's not on here. I'm sure it fits on one of these categories. But it's kind of a colloquial term, I guess, isn't it? Yeah. But you have loam, you have silty loam, you have clay, and then every soil has a percentage of each of these. You know, some clay, some silt, some sand. Okay, I know what I did here. Let me go to the next picture. You can do the jar test. If you want to find out what your soil is, the organic stuff will float to the top and you can get rid of that. But I like to use distilled water, put you a little dirt in the bottom, and you know, I like to fill about half full of dirt, right? So I can measure this really good. But then you shake it up real good, right? In your distilled water, and then you let it settle. And then you take a ruler, a millimeters is good because it's really, you know, millimeters are really small, and you measure the millimeters of the sand. The sand will go to the bottom, then the silt will settle out, and the clay will be on top. Now, this is sometimes hard to do, but this was really obvious, the silt, the clay. But the line between this and this is sometimes more of a texture thing than a color thing, okay? So you'll just look at, you'll see coarse, and then you'll see a little finer, and that's your line there. But every soil is different, and it's kind of fun to know what your soil is, and it helps you in a long run to know what you're dealing with, okay? And then when you get this, you can take your total measurement of the total amount and say, well, I got 50 millimeters here, and I got 15 millimeters that are sand. And then you can work that out as a percentage, and when you work it out as a percentage, then you can go back to this, and you can... Maybe you can punch in the internet when you find out what your soil texture is. You can punch it on the internet and find out how to work with it better. All the universities are into this stuff, and they got good. I'm not saying, you know, sometimes it sounds like I'm down on, you know, the university system. I'm not saying it's all bad. Where it's been, the university system has been corrupted by corporate, you know, corporations is bad. But there's a lot of good people in universities, and there's a lot of good information, and they've done a lot of research that can help you. So, you know, use that.
So what kind of soil are you want? You pick one.
What's the ideal soil?
Well, the ideal soil is probably this loam. This is a sweet spot right in the middle, you know. Sweet spot's always in the middle. You know, that clay loam is probably. I think that's what I was trying to get at here. See, this line runs this way. This line runs that way. So you, when you get those percentages, you just come in on each line. Clay goes this, these lines. And then wherever they all three meet is what you have. You see what I'm saying? Okay. It could feel, I have to look at that chart for a little while before I get it, you know. Sometimes I'm supposed to be going this way and I go that way. You know? But here's my soil. I took a picture of my jar test. And you see this? This is where the texture changed between the clay and the silt. And then here you can really see between the sand and the silt. This is the texture change here. It's not really a color change, but the color change happened between the silt and the clay. And then I worked out the math. I put the little post-it there, and I've got 17% clay, and 27% sand, and 50% silt. And I think that's what I did over here. Yeah, that's what I did over here. So I'm coming in here. I'm coming in here. Wait a minute. How does this work again? I go up here. Okay, you guys can probably figure that out later. I had it figured out at one point. But it works. I just, it takes a... Well, you don't need it. You're just—it's good. You're not going to change it. It's there. You're just good to know what. Just know what would work with what you got. Now we work. Do something we can deal with. This is called soil structure, or as some people say, aggregation. How those sand, silt, and clays are bound together. All right. And you can go to different parts of the earth, and because of the weather and the climate, they're bound together different ways. You got a, you know, like sand is like a single grain thing, and it has rapid porosity for water to go through. You got blocky, which sometimes clays work out to be, platy, which is slow to, you know, to infiltrate rain. Massive, you got prismatic, and then you got granular, and it's a little more rapid. So I think these are, you know, you got singular and then a little bit more granular. You got blocky and then a little bit more division there. And you got platy and then bound together plates, which becomes massive. So that's called aggregation or soil structure. Okay, question. Which one has the best structure or aggregation? Which one, left or right?
Right.
Right.
Easy. Which one has better aggregation?
Right.
Easy. So you guys got it. You're experts already. here's Rachel, who took over from Daniel at the farm. Remember, their farm on their at Gaia Gardens was part of the townhome. And when Daniel moved on, he had to because his wife found a good job. He moved on. He didn't want to, but he followed his wife to her good job. And Rachel, interviewed farmers. They put out feelers all over the country, said, come farm our farm. You know, it's an established farm. It's already making money. The farmer before, they made the farmer report his income. And they said, well, you know, the farmer before has made $90,000 a year on this acre and a half. And they want to recruit people. That's an enticement to get a farmer to come. The people that live in the townhomes won't want to do it. And they're smart. These people were smart. There's a very eclectic religiously group, but they were smart enough to realize that most of these people didn't want to be out there every day. They didn't have the proclivity to be out there farming, even though it was their land. And they said, here, take this land for $1 a month, and we'll supply the utility costs, and we just want to have first dibs on the produce. And we know, they did a lot of community stuff together. I mean, they did some of their own landscaping, and, you know, they hauled their trash for a while, you know, as a community. But they knew farming was too tough to do it as a volunteer commune thing. And there's too many chiefs and not enough Indians. And you try to get, like me and him, he's probably used to farming one way, and I'm probably used to farming another. And we'd sit there, and we'd spend more time fighting about how to do something than we would be getting anything done. You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of ways to skin the cat, and everybody has their own way of skinning that cat and what has worked for them. I don't have the same experience you have, you know. But anyways, they interviewed and got Rachel to come on, and this was her first year. She had a tough year first year because she was kind of thrown in the deep end of the pool because it's pretty demanding, you know. And but anyways, we had a big drought that year. We had a wet spring and then a dry summer, and you can see That's all. What is that? That's not smoke from the engine. That's dust coming up, and that's your clay, your colloid clay, and your colloid humus floating off in the wind. The best part of your soil floating off in the wind. What's the lesson there? If you can help it, don't till when it's really dry. Wait till a couple, 3 days after a rain. The thing that the reason in the 1930s they had something called the Dust Bowl, it was caused by the moldboard plow. Now, some people would argue with that, but I'm the moldboard plow. This was back in the 30s. You were getting into the industrial age. Everybody's gotten tractors now. They're not just a thing the rich people had, but everybody's getting able to afford tractors. You know, they're coming off the assembly lines. The prices come down. They have this tool called a moldboard plow, and it goes really deep, about a foot and a half, which maybe 2 feet, some of them. You know, you can get different sizes, and they weigh a ton, and they go really deep. And it takes soil down deep and flips it, totally inverts it. It has a nice, like, bow of a ship rake to it, and it just flips it. And when they first came out, man, they were never able to do that with the instruments before, and they just thought that was the best thing. Man, look at that dirt, man. We're really churning it, and we're flipping it over. Well, guess what? You destroyed all your soil biology because the stuff that liked it down deep doesn't like it on top. It likes it down deep where there's low oxygen. Things that are on top are now down deep, and they don't have oxygen. Your biology left the soil because of the moldboard plow. And then you're always going to get winds whipping through the middle of the country. That's like a wind tunnel, right, all through the Great Plains. And when they did that and they destroyed their biology, there went all the best part of their soil. And we lost a lot of our, I guess it blew up to Canada. And you know, we're still recovering from that. Huh?
What is the depth of the soil that you need to run?
Tell her what it is.
1 to 3 inches.
There you go. Poor soil structure results in water erosion and wind erosion, and it also results in sulfur. Because here you have water erosion. Now the guy's trying to grow a cover crop. It just rained on him, and he had a lot of erosion before it got established. But all your best part of your soil is leaving in that water. Okay. And when your big old raindrop hits a bad structure soil, if it's good soil, where's that book, verse in the Bible that says, if I fall on something, it's a good thing. It crushes you, right? But if you fall on me, it crushes you. But if I fall on you, I grind you to powder. What does that mean? Has anybody ever really done it? I don't know. I know that when a raindrop falls and there's no aggregation, it grinds that dust, that clay to a fine powder. You lose the aggregation. You lose any aggregation you had, and all that stuff runs off. And then when it dries up the next day, you get this hard surface crusting. Okay, and all those things are not good. And with good aggregation, you don't get the erosion, even when there's not a cover crop there, and you don't get the wind blowing it off, and you don't get this crusting. Here's a sort of a drawing of aggregation, and you can see here's the biology part, the fungal hypha, which acts as sort of a framework. Here's the, where's my bacterial slime? I don't know, one of these is probably bacterial slime, it should be. Kind of gluing it all together.
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Bacteria. There's bacteria, which are producing bacterial slime, thank you. 7 o'clock, I like that. Here's some more organic matter. Here's your bacteria called actinomycetes. And you can just get the picture. You got your sand up there. This whole big thing is the clay, okay, underneath that fungal hypha. And the biology, the bacteria and the fungi, the actinomycetes, the organic matter, are all, they're gluing that sand, silt, and clay together so it's tight but loose at the same time. Sort of a dichotomy, you know. I mean, it's bound together, and you get pore spaces where you can have water, and some of the pore spaces have air. You have your 25% water and air, and everything's bound together. It's held together. It resists erosion, but it has a lot of pore space. It's loosely bound. That's what we want by good aggregation. Here is the good aggregation. The secret of good aggregation is your biology. Funguses, which this is the thread, produce the glomalin, which is a sticky glue that binds things together, plus the fungus acts as a frame, like a, you know, 2x4s in a housing. And then your bacteria produce the bacteria slime, which sort of the glue, and binds it all together, and it's a polysaccharide. This I just threw in there because I drew this on a computer pad, and I thought it was kind of cool. But basically, you have animals, your consumers of your produce. They have a stomach, they have feli. The food goes in, it's digested, bacteria, the feli, it goes out as animal waste, and when it goes out as animal waste, it goes into the soil, and just think of the soil as kind of a stomach, and the microbes digest it, and this is your feli in the soil world taking it up, and then the cycle continues and continues and continues, and some of it here just leaches away. You want to try to keep that from happening. We'll get into leaching. Cross-section of the soil zone. This is, I sort of went over this before, but you know, the top 2 inches or 3 inches is where most of your biology is, and they're oxygen loving. Then the next 3 inches, about 5 inches, is you know, a little bit less biology, but here you till up here and you're destroying some of it so you can get some incorporation and get some dirt on your stuff, but you're not destroying it all the way down so this can repopulate this after you till. Okay, so that's why you don't deal too much and you don't deal too deep, because you don't want to get into this and all you have left is this oxygen depleted anaerobic zone. That's why you till shallow. Okay, and how deep is my aerobic zone? Well, you ever had a wooden tomato stake in the ground and you try to pull up and it broke? Where it broke is how deep your aerobic zone is. Your aerobic zone is as deep as a fence post rots. Okay? Soil structure management. Soil structure management. Okay, this is very important. Don't till when it's too wet, because you'll make bricks out there. Okay? Don't till when it's too dry, because you saw what happens then. It just blows away in the dust. Don't over-till. Don't deep-till. We don't have a subsoiler, because I don't have a tractor, so instead I have a thing called a broad fork, which I'm going to show you after lunch. Or you can spade fork it in. Everybody knows what a spade fork is, right? It's a short-handled, thick fork, right? Some people call it a potato fork or a digging fork or something like that. You can do it with that, or you can buy this broad fork, which is about $200, but well worth it. You can go a lot faster with it. And never walk on your growing beds. Use your walkways. That's how you manage your soil structure. You can't really affect your texture too much, you know, a little bit, but not too much. But you can have a great effect by your management practices on your soil structure. And soil structure saves the day. It's not about texture. You don't have to live in Illinois to have a great garden. Elliot Coleman is fond of saying, I live in Maine, and if you know anything about the Northeast, there's rocks everywhere. I took rocky Maine soil, and now it's producing great, high-quality, high-bricks food. Because why? Because he knew how to manage for soil structure. Soil structure management. Oh, this is another list. You got to feed your microbes, and you got to have water for your microbes, and they aggregate, mineralize, and decompose, and they never take a break. They're on the clock 24/7. Why not have that free labor working for you? And you're not. They love it. You're not doing it like you do the kids that go to independent academies and you got indentured servants. These guys love to work 24/7. Okay, they're happy at it. That's how they live. You can add microbes by making compost teas. Remember, we talked a little bit about aerated compost teas, not just compost anaerobic compost teas, but aerobic compost teas. You don't destroy your microbes with harsh fertilizers, herbicides, because when you destroy the biology with all this chemical stuff you're putting on, you're going to lose your structure because you're not going to have the biology. Then you're having to add compost from outside instead of making your own. Never leave your soil exposed. Always have a cover crop on there, whether it's when you're not going to cash crop, always have it covered with a cover crop. That helps your soil structure and your biology. Crop residue, after you get finished with a crop, I know some guy, you know, he said, we have the best watermelon. I said, what would you do with the residue? Oh, we haul it off, put it in the woods. It looked trashy. We didn't like it. I said, why don't you chop it up and till it in? He goes, oh, it looked too messy. Don't get hung up on things looking messy. You know, that's biology food. You know, that's everything that vine, that watermelon vine is. Okay, you ate the watermelon, you enjoyed that, but that vine is going to feed your biology. So give them some food too. They're giving you food. You give them some in return. And you know, you don't get hung up on something that looks too messy. You can make it look neat enough. Where is the other part? Cover crop, residue. Oh, calcium magnesium ratio. That's really important. Don't leave that out. If you get it, start getting tighter than 7:1 calcium magnesium ratio, you're going to tighten that up. The soil's going to tighten up, and you're not going to have the pore space. And if you don't have the pore space, you don't have the air. And if you don't have the air, aerobic loving biology can't breathe. Okay? So this 7:1 ratio in your mineral content is really important. You got to test for that. No way around it. County Extension Agent labs and the Land Grant University labs, they don't really give you that information. They're not cognizant of that. That's not important to them. That's not that they don't know about it. It's just they deem it not important. Here's a guy who makes a living small farming, Ken Dawson up at Maple Springs Farm. He's in Virginia. I like to throw these guys in because these guys are making a living small farming. Huh? Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't go for size really, but he's obviously proud of him. And he's an organic farmer, he started out certified organic, and we're at the end now. So we started out certified organic, and he introduced himself to the community, and he could say, look, you can trust me, I'm certified organic. But then after 3 or 4 years, he had a relationship with the people he sold his produce to. He's part of the community. They knew him. They could visit his farm. He knew them. Their purchases supported him. It's a nice cycle. Money changing hands is not a bad thing. And then he just dropped his certification because, heck, everybody that bought from him believed him anyway. And if you were a new customer, all you had to do was ask the old customers. They'd vouch for him.
But he still does the same.
He still does it organically. Yep. He's still an organic farmer, and he fits into that tight window that, you know, but that was his gig is, you know. But sometimes you have to get the certification in order for people to trust you because they don't know who you are. Then that certification gives them some guarantee, you know. And if you do follow right now, as the definition is written, if you follow the organic standards, it is good for the environment, and it's written very well. And I'm not saying it guarantees a product. You might still have a nutrient-deficient product because there's poor organic food. But it does guarantee a process. And some people buy this food because they don't want to rape the earth. You know, they're not really interested in the nutrient quantity. They're interested in about the environmental impact regular farming has. So they don't care that this, maybe he doesn't have the highest brick squash. What they care about is that he farms in a way that respects nature, which I think is something not just for the new age. I think we should all be concerned about that. Anyway, that's it. Have a good lunch. See you at 1:30.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.